is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
It is 1842. The United States Navy in its early decades, and an incident that is remembered as a mutiny. Sailing the graveyard sea, the deathly voyage of the Summers, the U.S. Navy's only mutiny and the trial that gripped the nation. Richard Snow is the author. I welcome you, Richard. I congratulate you. Your book is a fascination, not the least because it becomes suggestively the inspiration for two of Melville's masterpieces. Herman Melville also went to sea and had a relation with the crew of Summers. One is White Jacket. The other, of course, the famous and unfinished and much debated Billy Budd. The man who is the, if we're not taking too much liberty with Melville's memory, who may be an inspiration for Billy Budd, is named Philip Spencer. He's born 1824. Richard, what do we need to know about Philip Spencer as we precede him towards boarding the Summers? Good evening to you.
Good evening. Thank you. Well, the great naval historian Samuel Eliot Morison felt he only needed to sum him up by saying he was a young punk. And there is some truth to that, although if every adolescent boy was a young punk, hanged for it, the race would die out. But he was a very difficult child and unruly student. He had the misfortune to have a father who was both tremendously intelligent, one of the foremost lawyers of his day, and with a savage temper and a scorn for all human frailty. And Philip was a sort of a dreamer, and he withdrew. And he was, this is long before the Western bad man began shooting things up. So he withdrew into a popular literary genre of the time, which were stories about pirates. He read about pirates. The only constructive thing he seems to have done when he was in school was to donate to the school library a 400-page monolith called The Pirate's Own Book. And he kept screwing up in school, and his father, despairing, wanted to, you know, send him somewhere to shape him up. There was some talk about his being a dragoon on the Western frontier, but boy, for a restless, unhappy teenager, that didn't seem like a good, but in a ship, well, you were always under discipline. People were always looking at you. Nothing could go wrong there. And he got him a berth in the Navy. And he came aboard his first ship as a junior midshipman, which was the lowest real rank in the service. And he did not make himself popular. He hid liquor around the vessel. He was scornful, uncommunicative, surly. And he got himself transferred to another ship. And then he got in trouble there too. And the Navy was going to dump him, but he wrote a very mature and eloquent letter. He was no dope, saying how remorseful he was and how he wanted one more chance. And he got it. And he got it on quite an unusual ship. It was this was the USS Somers. She was one of the prettiest ships ever built in America, and the last to be powered by sail power alone, no steam engine. But she was small, a brig of war, 100 feet long, 20 feet wide, and she had brand new and had been taken over as the Navy's first experiment with actually educating its officers and sailors. She was the first school ship. Before that, it had just been throw them in the water and see if they can swim.
All right, we've got Philip to the Summers. A couple of details that emerged from your very careful telling. He has a disability. He's wall-eyed. He's born with a disability. He takes an operation to correct it, which is only partially effective. It helps his seeing, but he has a cast to his eye. So when talking to him directly, it can appear to superstitious eyes that he's casting an evil eye or in some fashion presenting a face that is not trustworthy. Also, at the same time, you mentioned his pirate thinking. He's a daydreamer. He makes things up. And at one time, he makes up a fraternity that's still with us, Kai Sai. And the way he invents Kai Sai is they invent a list of people who can join and who cannot. It strikes me that it's important here because it's not at all too far to go from a list about Kai Sai to a list about a pirate ship. He is a convincing speaker as well. Did he boast of how he tells stories and how people listen to him? Was that part of his life?
Oh, yes. He was also very fussy about who he talked to. So there only people worthy of listening to him would get to hear him. He was never very popular except among the members of the fraternity he founded, which is still active on 32 campuses or something. It's his only monument to the guy.
Importantly, the pirate ship, as you say, it was the popular fiction of the time. Today we have superheroes, we have TV, we have video, all of that for the imagination of young people who are moving around and learning how to move into a world of adults. So let's go to the adults in this tragedy. Chief among them, the commander of Summers. His name is Mackenzie, but it's important to understand how he got that name, because he's born Slidell. Why is he called Captain Mackenzie?
He is called Captain Mackenzie because he had an uncle in Scotland who had no children and was getting very very worried that his name would die out, a thought that was unhappy to him. So he struck a deal with Slidell and said, look, you take my name and I'll give you my inheritance. You'll have a lot of money. And so it happened quickly. Lieutenant Slidell disappeared and became, at that same instant, Lieutenant Mackenzie. And he kept his part of the bargain and carried the name, got the money, nice home on the Hudson, and was very happy with that outcome.
And a home on the Hudson near the farm of Washington Irving, because earlier in his life, Alexander Slidell had the good fortune of running into or meeting, when he was out taking a year off from the Navy, Washington Irving, extremely famous author at this time, in both America and Europe. And Washington Irving takes him under his wing as an assistant, because Irving's writing a book about Christopher Columbus, and here is a Navy man to help him with the terms of sailing the ocean blue. And they become friends and confidants. Strikingly, though, Irving helps him write a bestseller. Again and again, Richard, I'm struck by the prose that Mackenzie writes. He has a very high opinion of his prose, but it's extremely difficult to read.
Oh, it's clotted and always interrupted with a salute to the flag or to himself.
He did not write A Year in Spain. Irving wrote it. Can we agree on this?
Oh, I was near as damn it, yeah.
But the Navy doesn't know that, so it's in every wardroom in the Navy, along with...
That's amazing. And it became a bestseller.
While he was at sea, he had no idea that it was being sent up the flag in Europe and America. He sells lots of copies. He's already independently wealthy. He's well married, and he has a good marriage. He's at sea. Everything seems to be for his rise to being a famous American author, except for that's not real, and a famous American captain, except for he has a peculiarity, a weakness, or a tragic detail. That's the nature of tragedy. He's violent. He's a flogging captain. Why? How? Where does it come from? You talk about him witnessing executions. What attracts him?
I don't know. And there's something that when I first saw that he'd written all these travel books and not wonderfully readable, I was sort of miserable. I thought, oh, hell, I was too stupid at first to realize that what an immense advantage it was if I was trying to figure out a mid-19th century naval officer's character, to have hundreds of pages in his own voice, all in the first person. And what came out to me was that he's very rigid and proper. He's very worthy of the God that reigns above him and this and that. But he has a taste for violence that he writes about with almost lubricious, slightly pornographic detail. He goes to, he hears there's a hanging in Spain. He goes to it. Then he writes a pious little thing about how disgraceful it was and how this could not, he'll never do this again. And 3 weeks later, he's back at another one. 3 weeks later, he's back at another one. And always telling exactly the last squirm and groan of the victim. And this is not like any memoir I've ever read before. It's sandwiched with, you know, boring obviousnesses, but he always comes back to a microscopic discussion of human suffering.
Yes, I could not read The Garroting. I skipped it. You weren't giving us the whole detail, just quotes from it. He witnesses it, and he talks about the tightening of the screw. He becomes a flogging captain. He was singled out in the U.S. Navy. There was a pamphlet published by a sailor saying, watch out for this captain.
Yes, and when he got back from his cruise with Philip Spencer, the commandant of the New York Navy Yard, who was no shrinking violent, was absolutely horrified when he saw the records of the floggings of teenage boys on this cruise. And he said McKenzie was very careful to stay inside of the limits of the law. You were only allowed to give 12 lashes, but that he still was able to accomplish more in this grim way than anyone he'd ever heard of. And he thought he didn't deserve to keep his command.
Let's get on board, Summers. It's September 1842. We're about to set sail for a cruise to Africa and back with a lot of young men on board, midshipmen's. Before there was a naval academy, this was understood to be an educational process. The book is Sailing the Graveyard Sea, The Deathly Voyage of the Summers, the U.S. Navy's Only Mutiny, and the Trial That Gripped the Nation. Richard Snow is the author. I'm John Batchelor.